Welcome to Women on Air, a weekly show about women, feminism, and social justice, brought to you by CFUV's Women's Radio Collective.
Hello, you are listening to CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. We also stream online at cfuv.uvic.ca. And you are listening to Women on Air. So I have a cool show for you today, brought to you by our friends out east at Talking Radical Radio. They have a really cool interview about racism and settler colonialism in Thunder Bay. So we're going to jump right into that because it's quite a long but very interesting interview. So stay tuned.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio. Hello, and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people that are facing many different struggles talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening is a crucial step in strengthening all of our efforts to change the world. On this week's show, I will be speaking with Jana Ray Yerxa and Damien Lee. Thunder Bay is a small city on the north shore of Lake Superior in northwestern Ontario. Like pretty much everywhere in Canada, racism has long been a daily reality for residents of the city who are not white. Like most communities with roots in resource extraction industries, the racism faced by Indigenous people in the city has always had a particular character and intensity. In the last 6 months, though, there's been a significant upsurge in racism in the city. There has been some official and mainstream response to this racism, but activists on the ground point out that this response has been woefully inadequate. Yerxa is from Kuchiching First Nation and lives in Thunder Bay, and Lee is from Fort William First Nation, which is right next to the city. In response to this recent upsurge, they and a number of other Anishinaabe people in the city have formed the Bishkabiyong Collective. They organized a teach-in for Indigenous people in the city to discuss racism and settler colonialism in a safe space and equip themselves to better respond to it in ways grounded in Anishinaabe tradition, political orders, and philosophy. They've been providing some loose input to a group of settlers, that is, non-Indigenous people in the city, who have been organizing separately to respond to the racism, and they've been clearly naming the inadequacy of the official responses that have amounted to a focus on educating white people about Indigenous people, with little or no attention to racism and white supremacy as structural things, and no mention at all of white supremacy as a tool of settler colonialism. Yerxa and Lee talk with me about the situation in Thunder Bay, about the work of the Bishkabiyong Collective, and about what needs to happen to challenge white supremacy and settler colonialism. I spoke with them by Skype to phone from Thunder Bay.
My name is Damien Lee. I'm from Fort William First Nation, which is right next to Thunder Bay, Ontario. I'm a PhD student at the University of Manitoba in Native Studies.
And my name is Jana Ray Yerxa, and I'm an Anishinaabeg from Kuchiching First Nation, which is from Treaty 3 territory, and I'm a recent iGov graduate.
Just a quick interruption to clarify for listeners, iGov is the Indigenous Governance Program at the University of Victoria.
Jan and I have been organizing in a loose collective called the Bishkabiyong Collective. And that collective is focused mostly on supporting and fostering Anishinaabe resurgence here in the Thunder Bay area, I guess more broadly too. A lot of that work is bound up in consciousness raising and discussing settler colonialism, white supremacy, and Anishinaabe political orders that can respond to that and also be proactive about asserting Anishinaabe presences in this territory.
Damien and I got to know each other not in person, but because we were involved in the iGov program, which is known for being really good at deconstructing settler colonialism and centering Indigenous ways of knowing. And so we got to know each other that way, and it just so happened that when I moved back to Thunder Bay shortly after Damien also moved back, and when we got together here in Thunder Bay, we both talked about how we struggled with the way racism gets addressed in the city here because Thunder Bay makes it safe for racism to exist. A lot of times, the strategies used to address racism are all about focusing on educating settler Canadians about Aboriginal people and Aboriginal history and an Aboriginal experience, and it's decontextualized from the realities of settler colonialism, which is really problematic because then it reproduces racism where you're focusing on the other and you're not called to take responsibility for how you're going to be in those relationships. And so Damien and I met another lady through social media, actually, who had similar type of politics. And we got together with a few others and we decided that we were going to do a teach-in to assert a Anishinaabeg presence and also begin to unpack the realities of settler colonialism.
Thunder Bay has a long history of being an unsafe space for Anishinaabeg. It's a heavy resource town. There's a high indigenous population here and a reserve right next to the city. And it's very isolated too. So that combination, in my books, creates the conditions where white supremacy can really gain strength. If we put it in a larger colonial context, you know, the intention of Canada historically to remove indigenous peoples from the land to exploit their resources for the benefit of nation building, that carries through into towns where it's heavily based on resource extraction, where an indigenous presence is seen as suspect, or it raises questions like, do we have the right to be exploiting resources from indigenous people's lands that have been stolen from a history of colonialism in Canada? For me, that's the macro context. And that has made Thunder Bay an unsafe place for generations for Anishinaabeg. However, since October, there's been a shift in the anti-indigenous racism here that I've observed. And what happened was at the end of October, there was a bridge that links the city of Thunder Bay to the reserve next to it. So that's Fort William First Nation. And that bridge was set on fire through vandalism. In the hours after it was burning, the political leaders came out to say, you know, we have to get to the bottom of this. We're going to find the culprit. That kind of rhetoric. Very little was said about social media. Twitter that night was very anti-Indigenous. Many people were saying, let the bridge burn and we hope it burns the rest of the res. Let's save Thunder Bay. And those kind of sentiments. Basically, this is for the city because the Indians are going to be totally pushed back or, you know, in the words of some people, burned. Now, economically, what that did is shut down a very important economic link between the reserve and the part of the city close to the reserve. And there was some organizing in the months after that about trying to fix the bridge or address the bridge issue because both communities were losing a lot of money. And that's where Tamara Johnson first appeared. She was, at that time, a provincial conservative candidate, and she basically championed this thing of, like, First Nations get an illegal tax break because they can sell gas and smokes cheaper than people in the city. And that's where it really started, in the sense of she championed that issue, and because of that, she actually got dropped from the Conservative Party and was later picked up by the Libertarian Party. And that really set off the spike in racism that continues to grow here. She came out and, in my opinion, became a hero for people who are feeling disenfranchised financially for any number of reasons. She has a lot of followers, and it seems like those people that are following have some sort of beef, whether it's about loss of jobs or like the Ontario and Canadian tax system or whatever. But the way that the rhetoric is structured is that it's Indigenous people's fault. It's basically scapegoating. Basically, it's asserting that settler colonialism has the full right, and it's just natural that white people in Canada should have access to all the resources and should be protected financially from any kind of economic issues, especially in the north here.
Our teach-in, it was really loosely advertised, and we had a really great turnout. We were kind of surprised about that because we had about 40 people show up during a blizzard, and from the teach-in, you could really tell that people were quite motivated to have a different type of discussion around racism and begin to unpack the realities of settler colonialism. We looked at a lot of checkback messages that aim to really shut down conversations around racism and settler colonialism and white supremacy.
That teach-in, which was held in April, it was very clear to me, like Jana touched on, the people that were in the room who were, I would say, 99% Anishinaabeg, they were really eager for a space and a conversation that they didn't feel shut down when they asserted themselves as people concerned about ending racism. And what I mean by that is that the folks that attended, you know, they live in Thunder Bay. And like Jana mentioned, the anti-racism organizing in Thunder Bay the actual initiatives that are being rolled out to end racism in this town are actually very safe for racism because of the way that they are structured in the discourse of like focusing on individual acts of racism, totally excluding structural aspects of it all. So these people, I think it was very clear to me that when they were in that room and they could say the words white supremacy, they could say the word settler, they could say the word colonialism, they didn't have to prove that those things existed. And that, I think, was very validating and very relieving for them. Because once they found that they could say those things and, you know, the people organizing the event didn't check them back into place by saying, oh, we can't use that word, or, oh, you know, don't point out someone's whiteness. You know, once they had a space that they themselves didn't feel that they were facing this barrage of checkback messages again, it was clear that they dug in. They were fully present and they wanted to talk about it. And I think it was very validating for them to have that space. So much to the point that when the teaching was over, we kind of had to kick people out, mostly because we were losing the space and it was late at night. We had to go home. But there was a real eagerness there.
Tell me a little bit more about some of those messages that you talked about at the teach-in and the kinds of tools that you helped people to develop to identify and challenge them.
There's a bunch of classic ones, such as, like, I'm not a settler, I was born here. You know, treaties were signed a long time ago, or get over it.
Like, that was a long time ago, that wasn't me, what does this have to do with me? Or, not all white people are like that.
Or, one of my favorites is, that's reverse racism. You know, making, you know, bringing whiteness into view and saying that whiteness is part of a problem, just naming that is received as, that is reverse
hostile.
Racism, right? Yeah,
hostile. It's almost like you're swearing if you say white people. Another one is, this is one of my favorites, this is just the beginning.
Oh, God.
What happens is, when we start to engage in strategies that are presented to address racism, and we start off with just, let's educate about Aboriginal people, or let's talk about residential schools, which is really super important, but it's all decontextualized again from the realities of settler colonialism. There's this pushback to say, well, this is just the beginning. We have to start somewhere. But what's problematic is that beginning and that starting point is reproduced over and over and over again, and it doesn't move beyond that. So then that's when it becomes a checkback message.
The fact that history of 200 or 300 years of resistance, the fact that Anishinaabe are still here, still speaking Anishinaabe language, all these things is totally, as Jenna said, decontextualized from an act that is seen as just the beginning, right? And that really sums up all those checkback messages for me. Is what they do is they decontextualize whatever action is taking place from settler colonialism in a way that settler colonialism gets to continue on. So these checkback messages work to shut down conversations so that the conversation doesn't get close enough to the problem.
And those checkback messages, those are the micropolitics of settler colonialism that plays out every single day. And those are acts of violence, and those are aimed to shut down Indigenous voice and erase Indigenous presence. And although they are so normal, they are still very violent. And really, I think what was so powerful about the teach-in, and when we talk about how the people that participated, the onus and the burden of proof wasn't put on them to prove that this is in fact racism, or this is in fact settler colonialism, and that they could just talk freely. I think it speaks to how those micro politics that happen every day when it comes to settler colonialism, how it weighs heavy on the Indigenous psyche, and that those everyday acts are not separate and isolated from the larger structural issues that we talk about today, such as residential schools, such as the 60s scoop, such as the Indian Act. They're all connected, and they help to maintain the order of settler colonialism through white supremacy.
And I think that when people left the room, they had those 20 or so checkback messages on their email, so that when they were engaging in conversation, again, in their own lives, or observing official responses to racism, or seeing, you know, racism being discussed in the media, they now have some tools that they can draw on to say, like, no, we need to continue this conversation beyond that message you just gave me, because that message is actually working to shut me down. So I think that that list was a tool that they could use to strengthen the work that they're doing in their own lives, whatever the case. you know, racism and semi-colonialism manifest in a number of different ways that these people were going back into their daily jobs and daily lives. And at least maybe they have these messages now to help diagnose the ways that those messages are working to shut them down.
And what came after that initial teach-in? How did you build on that interest and enthusiasm in having those conversations?
We're planning to do another set of teach-ins. We haven't done one yet, but that's mostly because of getting busy in the summer. I would say that one of the most profound things that came out of that teach-in initially is that the collective itself was able to start addressing issues of racism and settler colonialism in the Thunder Bay community with some validity. We weren't coming out of the woodwork, and I think that people were interested to follow the discourse that we were putting into the community. And that had a lot of traction in the discussion about racism in the last 3 months. People are looking for answers in terms of how to address the more overt acts of racism happening here right now. And there has been a settlers, in some ways, there's been a settlers in solidarity group forming that I think has really benefited from the work that we're doing in the community, which is focused on, you know, naming settler colonialism and working with Anishinaabeg. This group that is forming, in some ways, is informed by that discussion that I don't think that they would have had if the age-old narratives about ending racism were the only thing they could choose from here.
I think that another thing that we did do was the Ontario Libertarian Party candidate who was running in the provincial election published an ad in the Chronicle Journal that was presented as her political platform, but really it was a lot of anti-Indigenous sentiment and was hate speech. And so when the Chronicle Journal published the ad, another thing that the Biscobion Collective did was we responded not to the Chronicle Journal and not to the political candidate, but what we did was we looked through the Chronicle Journal to see who advertises with them. And what we did was we wrote a letter to the people that advertised in the Chronicle Journal just explaining what was problematic about the Chronicle Journal publishing the ad. And again, highlighting the structural issues of settler colonialism and how that plays out with racism. And basically gave the people that advertise in the Chronicle Journal a few options in terms of the fact that they are getting money from Indigenous people. And then if they're going to continue to advertise with the Chronicle Journal, how do they justify taking money from Indigenous people and then fund a media outlet that is okay publishing hate speech? We really wanted to make sure that our letter wasn't just about saying, hey, this is wrong, but putting accountability measures in place, which again goes back to our collective about centering Anishinaabeg ways of knowing, because accountability is huge when it comes to our political practices and philosophy.
And that letter was made public the day before the Ontario election. So there was a lot of traction because the ad that she's talking about in the Chronicle Journal came out, I guess, 2 days before the election. So the next day, a number of Indigenous organizations respond publicly about it. And we assumed that that would be the case. So we also responded publicly with that letter. And I think the strategy was bang on. People came out denouncing the ad, denouncing the candidate, denouncing the Chronicle Journal. And so one of the gaps that was left open was, you know, what about people funding the Chronicle Journal? So I think that that was what played on our part, but also in terms of the collective of Indigenous organizing here. All together, we all came out and addressed various aspects of that whole problem, right? Which really underlined for me, or at least exposed, the structural elements of it all.
Talk about the ways that you see white supremacy and settler colonialism as not the same things, but as linked. And how you talk about that, the language that you've come up with in the work the collective has done, and why you think it matters to have that focus.
Settler colonialism, for me, is the context and the historical trajectory that has produced the state of Canada that we know today. And when I think about it like that, white supremacy, racism, homophobia, sexism, these are different tools that are deployed to protect the settler colonial order. And for me, focusing just on ending racism without also including a critique of settler colonialism, it leaves settler colonialism uninterrogated and therefore allowed to persist. And so racism is just one tool in a settler colonial context deployed to protect settler colonialism. And so if we organize where we just focus on racism, we're at risk of reproducing a discourse that settler colonialism is reproduced in organizing that we do. Therefore, if we put settler colonialism on the table, if we critique settler colonialism in our work, we include it as the operating system or the construct that is the real root of the problem. And we can therefore, at that point, start developing responses or initiatives that seek to remove or work around the state, the settler colonial state in itself. And for me, that's a form of self-determination where Indigenous peoples and settlers, if they're organizing directly with each other as opposed to relying on instruments put forward by the state or in kind of a more local context, instead of relying on initiatives put forward by the city, if we're forming real relationships that way, then we're acting with more self-determination in a way that we don't just automatically or invisibly reproduce the root of the problem. So for me, they're very different things, white supremacy, racism versus settler colonialism. One's a tool, whereas the other one is really the root cause or the root problem.
In the city here, a lot of the strategies put forward, as I mentioned earlier, they don't even talk about the tool of white supremacy or whiteness. So it's still about, like, let's talk about racism and let's try to alleviate that by educating about Aboriginal people, which speaks to how powerful the tools are and how elusive settler colonialism is. And I agree with Damien that racism is a tool. It's a manifestation of settler colonialism. And unless we start to have those discussions about settler colonialism, we just always run the risk of reproducing it and not getting into a different type of relationship that I think a lot of us want to engage in.
You've mentioned that it's not central to the work that you've been doing, but you have had some connection with the settler group in Thunder Bay that's been doing some organizing in response to the racism and in response to settler colonialism. Tell me a little bit about what you see in that work that is promising and encouraging, and also what you see that is perhaps worth being wary about and being careful about.
First thing to say is it's very, very new. That organizing is just in its very nascent stage. I guess that could be a checkback message in some way, which overlooks the kind of resistance that non-Indigenous people have done here in the past decades. But in terms of coming together as a group of people discussing settler colonialism, that is very new and it's happening right now. That discussion is getting deeper and deeper into addressing what can be done. That's a conversation that's somewhat separate from the work Jen and I have done, although that I've been active in trying to inform those settlers in town that are trying to organize. And the reason is, if we're going to work with allies, in my books, I think it's really important that those allies don't reproduce any tropes that can actually reassert settler colonialism in the process. My approach to that has really been to draw people together who've been contacting me as somebody who's been vocal and in the media about this stuff. I've been drawing those people together saying, you need to speak to each other about this stuff. They're starting to do that. I think that they're carrying themselves ethically. They're going through an unlearning process in the sense that they know they need to do something about racism, and they know that what's been going on in the city the last 6 months especially is very wrong. But in terms of unlearning, they're having discussions with me about how to carry themselves in their own initiatives. So I've been trying to supply them with readings and information that sums up in some ways the discussion we're having here right now about not making this about learning more about Indians. It's about flipping the lens and making sure that they're carrying themselves in a way that has a critique of settler colonialism, so that when they go to do work with people who are either getting caught up in this racist stuff or kind of oblivious to it all, they don't just reproduce the problems of, like, let's learn about Indians or focusing just on racism. So they're engaging in a way that brings the structural elements into play, and they're engaging in a way that brings settler colonialism into view. But it's very new. They're just organizing that right now. In the discussion, they demonstrated that before all this stuff happened, before reading information about settler colonialism and linking it to structural issues, they would have gone out and said, let's learn more about Indians, and would have gone out and discussed racism completely decontextualized from settler colonialism, and might not have placed all this work within a broader context of living in Anishinaabe territory. That's where it is for me. Like, that's what I've observed, and I'm really happy with that in the sense that they are informing themselves and they're coming together in a way that is open to the possibility that they could become part of the problem just by operating with good intentions. I think it's becoming clear to them that good intentions aren't enough in working to address settler colonialism as a settler solidarity group. I think that's really positive, and I think bodes well for the work that they're just now developing. And where it is right now is they're trying to develop a strategy, basically how to, I don't know the best way to say it, you know, win souls from the most hardcore racists in town right now. They're trying to figure out how to reach those people who are just looking for answers, but being spoon-fed these really racist answers and buying into that. they're trying to like reach those people who might be able to be swayed back to the more ethical anti-racist approach.
Part of the process of learning or unlearning, however we're going to talk about it, is it's so important to work with the people that want to do the work. Doing this type of work takes a lot of energy, and it's about investing that energy with people that are motivated to do the work, people that really dig in their heels. It's not about placating to them and, you know, reinforcing that white privilege and white supremacy and coddling people. When I look at my own decolonization process, like, nobody held my hand. And so I don't think that we should expect to do that with settlers either.
Give me a sense of the kinds of things that it would be useful for your collective and the broader communities of which your collective is a part to be doing to challenge settler colonialism and white supremacy.
Where we're at with things, I think that there's still a strong need to diagnose racism and how it plays out, to diagnose settler colonialism. One of the barriers is that I think that people believe that talking about settler colonialism is something that should only be happening in an academic realm. People right now, like, sometimes we lack the language to diagnose and to talk about settler colonialism. And I think the fact that we lack the language speaks to how powerful it is. And so right now it's just about putting the language there and diagnosing it.
Yeah, and just to build on that, diagnosis is such an important part of all this. However, it's not the only part. The other part that's really important is that, like Janice said, we're centering Anishinaabe political, legal, cultural orders that come to play a very important role in how we respond to racism and settler colonialism in Thunder Bay. As we center Anishinaabe political orders, legal orders, and philosophies in our work, we're not only just diagnosing, we're also representing or strengthening Anishinaabe presence in Anishinaabe territory, which is a form of resurgence. It's a form of resistance because of the settler colonial context that we're in, which has been predicated on removing Indigenous peoples or silencing Indigenous peoples from this land currently called Canada. So the way I look at our work is it's like a balloon. It's doing two things at once. As you blow up a balloon, you are diagnosing and pushing back on the outside settler colonial context. However, as you're doing that, you're also filling up the balloon with warm air. So that's the filling up or the resurgence or the re-strengthening of Anishinaabe presence, Anishinaabe philosophies, political orders, all that stuff that is bound up with being Anishinaabe and being a part of the Anishinaabe nation. A balloon is blowing up and making space, a safe space, where Anishinaabe can be in their territory and not have to feel threatened or unsafe because of the colonial context. That really metaphorically sums up the work that we're doing. It's not just about diagnosis, which is a really important part of it. It's also about recentering and re-strengthening.
You have been listening to my interview with Jana Ray Yerxa and Damian Lee of the Bishkabiyong Collective. We have been talking about the struggle against racism and settler colonialism in Thunder Bay, Ontario. To learn more about the collective, you can follow them on Twitter at symbol BISKAABIYANG. To find out more about Talking Radical Radio, the guests, the theme music, and the ways that you can listen, or to make suggestions about topics for future shows, go to talkingradical.ca and click on the link marked radio. That's talkingradical.ca.
So you are listening to Women on Air, and that was an episode done by our friends at Talking Radical Radio out east. So, coming up next, we have another interview from Talking Radical Radio. They interviewed a woman about her feminist summer camp, and I've actually been looking through the website. I would highly recommend anybody who's interested to check it out. It's called feministsummercamp.weebly.com, and you're going to hear the interview in a couple minutes. And they have some really great resources on their resources page about many different topics of intersectionality, privilege, being an ally, the history of feminism in Canada. So if you like the interview and you want to find out more, definitely check out their website. I have been really thoroughly enjoying all the resources they have there. So enjoy.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio. Hello and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people that are facing many different struggles talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening is a crucial step in strengthening all of our efforts to change the world. On this week's show, I will be speaking with Tanya Andrusechko. None of us would evolve politically without opportunities to encounter new critical ideas about the world. Such encounters may not be sufficient for political growth, but I think they're necessary. And even better than merely encountering new ideas is having opportunities to work through them with other people, to discuss, to debate, to mutually self-educate, and to make meaning together in ways much more likely to allow the ideas to seep into our choices and actions. And more than just being about individual growth, such encounter and dialogue are central to how movements happen and grow. Yet for all of that, movements in North America today don't tend to be all that intentional about creating spaces where such encounter and dialogue can happen. Sure, there will be sporadic teach-ins about the issue of the moment, and planning meetings and public events are often informally spaces for such mutual learning, but given its importance, we're not usually all that deliberate about it. Andrusechko's most recent project suggests one way that movements might do just that. She felt the need for a space to have deliberate, serious, sustained conversation about feminist ideas, and she also wanted to find a way to become politically involved in what is still a relatively new to her community, Saskatoon. So she decided she would organize a feminist summer camp. The same 20 participants are getting together one night a week for 10 weeks to cover a wide range of feminist topics. They're hearing speakers, they're discussing ideas, they're building skills. And Andrusechko hopes they will all leave the camp better able to intervene in feminist ways in their own everyday lives, and perhaps some will be inspired to new collective feminist activity as well. I spoke with her about her path to this work, about the format of the camp, and about what she hopes it will achieve. I spoke with her by Skype to phone from Saskatoon.
My name is Tanya Andrusechko, and I am the founder of the first ever feminist summer camp in Saskatoon. I come from Toronto, and I come from a very culturally rich upbringing in an urban center. I participated in a lot of social justice work as a young person, including with homelessness and campaigns around Students for a Free Tibet. I have a background in social justice work where the themes have come out around justice and self-determination, but one of the issues that I realized in my youth involvement in social justice work was that my own lived experiences weren't reflected in the work that I was doing. And this is really one of the major moments in my experience where I've really pulled out my lived experience as a woman in Canadian society. And I decided to put together this feminist summer camp as a way to bring together people with diverse lived experiences as feminists to learn from each other and to create safe and encouraging spaces to discuss complex social gender issues and learn from each other and grow as allies and grow as feminists and deepen our practice as feminists. The goal is to learn about these complex intersecting issues affecting women and to bridge expert knowledge with lived experiences and to build skills around framing feminist issues. The group is a very strong group, so it's a really incredible experience so far with Feminist Summer Camp. My experience working with social justice work around urban homeless issues and housing issues and then the Tibetan sovereignty movement were really formative in shaping my ideas of what allyship is and can be. The fact of the matter was that I have no experience with homelessness, and I'm not Tibetan. So those are both issues that I care very deeply about and found a sense of very strong empathy for, but they were not my experiences, and I couldn't speak from a first-hand account about what that meant. And I had one experience where I was asked actually to step back in my involvement. That was a teachable moment for me. I really realized that speaking on behalf of other people was not working, and appropriating voice and speaking on behalf of other people when other people have total capacity to speak for themselves. that was a humbling moment because I thought I was there, you know, for the right reasons and coming from a good place. And I may have been, but it wasn't coming across in a way that really respected the principles of allyship, of listening more so than speaking on behalf of other people. So I stepped back for a few years to really reevaluate what my role was in the social justice movement. And it was actually many years that I sat back a little bit and observed a lot, and I listened a lot. It was a steep learning curve, but a really important learning curve that made me really rethink how I was going to position myself in the work that I do. So I can witness that there are injustices and there's oppression everywhere around us, but I need to speak responsibly, and I need to speak for myself and learn how to be a strong ally. But coming into the feminism side of this really came out of my own experiences as a woman, and especially in the retail and service sector. I worked as a server and I worked in sales for a few years when I was going through school. And I may not have realized it at the time, but looking back on it, those were really formative experiences in that they made me realize that when women are in public spaces, so in shops and in restaurants, that they can be very unsafe and threatening and hostile spaces to a lot of women, in the sense that there's a sense of entitlement to comment on women's bodies and women's work and women's positions. And that can be really problematic, and that can have a cumulative effect. And it did have a cumulative effect on me, in that I really internalized my work in these public spaces as service to other people, and that it was okay to comment on my appearance and my physicality and my role there. And there was a breaking point with that. And that really was a pretty formative moment in my own feminism. And that was one of those moments where I realized that as a woman, I will always be the subject of some kind of commentary and assessment and evaluations. Since coming out of, you know, the retail sector, I've really realized that I am surrounded by issues that require feminist action and feminist consciousness. So that's kind of been my transition from speaking irresponsibly on behalf of other people to learning about what it is to be an ally, to coming into my own feminist activism as a woman who can speak about her own lived experiences. This is really a moment in my life now where I am learning to do social activism based on my own experiences and my own observations of the society that we live in and the impact of the culture that we live in on my own life and my own experiences and opportunities. So I was meeting up with a friend on a regular basis. She was assigned to me as a coach initially. This came out of a national program called Next Up, which is a leadership program for young people who identify with progressive values. Part of that is being paired up with a Next Step alum. And it was just through weekly conversations with this coach that I started realizing that maybe not adding myself to existing boards and groups, which are doing incredible work, but they weren't quite resonating with what I wanted to see, which was a continued conversation with the same people in a learning environment and growing that network. And I thought, I just feel like I would like to just start something. And she said, why not? Why don't you just start this? And it was really that easy. Like, it was really just someone saying, so just do it. And the other part of that is I had these disjointed conversations with a number of friends about different feminist issues that were coming up either in the news or sort of these trends that we're seeing in feminism, especially around lean in and neoliberalism and appropriation of feminist goals by neoliberalism. And I was having these conversations with friends around these issues, and they'd creep up, and then the conversation would not really see the light of day for a few weeks. And so there wasn't that sort of sustained ability to have these deeper conversations. And I realized that there really is a need to have an intentional, deliberate place to really explore these issues where there is no distraction, we're all on the same page, and we're all there to learn and deepen it. So the first step was to create goals. I had goals that were sort of floating around in my brain, and I had to link them to the vision. And so I created a document that had lots of headings and subheadings around what those objectives were, what the goals were, how to get to those goals. So that would mean, for instance, that skill building was a goal. because what I didn't want was for this to be 10 venting sessions. I didn't want to just be getting together with people who have experienced marginalization or discrimination and just talk about that, despite the fact that those are important experiences to validate and to talk about. There had to be the camp aspect of this, the actions behind what we were experiencing and how to turn those experiences into actions. So I put together that document that really outlined what the goals were. So knowledge creation and skill building were really the two big goals. Once I did that, I really just started to talk to people and say, can we be involved in this in some way or another? So I connected with the coordinator of Next Step, Tracy Mitchell in Saskatoon, and asked her about, you know, facilitation principles and how to bring people together. I put together the website. But then I just started asking people who would be a good contact point for this issue or that issue. And I brainstormed a list of feminist topics that could be sessions. From there, I started asking people that I thought have really great insight and analysis into these issues, sent in emails to people and had conversations with other people in the community who are very well connected. And that was a big part of this project because I'm not from Saskatoon. I live in Saskatoon and I'm lucky to live in Saskatoon because of the strong sense of community, but I'm relatively new here. I really call on that community and that sense of wanting to work on this together. I had lots of recommendations. I had people who said you should talk to this person and that person, and people said I'm happy to write that email for you and make that introduction. Twitter was a major part of this as well. So it all really came together with this underlying sense of community, both in the physical community, the actually Saskatoon, and also with the online community. I looked at what other people in other jurisdictions are doing around feminist skill building. So there were lots of to-do lists, lots of emails, lots of asking for help. And someone told me, in order to do social justice work, you have to ask for an embarrassing amount of help. So ask for help whenever you can for whatever you need. And the amazing thing is that people say yes all the time. And I couldn't be more grateful for that. It amazes me that I can reach out to someone and they're right there 10 minutes later responding to my email and saying, of course, I'd love to help and I'd love to be a part of this in some way, even if, you know, just to recommend two other people that you could talk to. So that's been a pretty uplifting and encouraging experience. And I owe so much of my own organizational success around this to other people agreeing to help and wanting to be a part of this.
Tell me about the form of the camp itself. How is it structured? How does it work?
So it's 10 weeks, and it takes place on Monday nights from 6 until 9. It started on May 26th, and it runs until July 28th. Each Monday night, we have different speakers come and share their analysis on different issues around gender and feminism. The introduction to the camp was on contemporary feminist issues, so sort of the bigger trends in feminism, the history of feminism, like the waves, and problematizing placing major feminist events into waves when in fact there's a lot of continuity throughout that timeline and a lot of people who contributed to various moments in different waves. And so, you know, that was the first session and we talked about things like vocabulary and words that are social justice oriented or specifically feminist terminology. And we did a lot of establishing concepts in that first session. And every Monday from now until the end of the program will be very diverse, like very different issues. So talks about feminism in other progressive spaces, so feminism within environmentalism and what happens when people in the environmental movement experience sexism and experience discrimination or gender blindness. And, you know, we can't assume that if we're all progressive that we all get gender discrimination because there are still gaps there that exist. And so we have someone coming in to talk to us about what to do. So this is a very skills-based session. What to do when a safe space, supposedly, you know, like a progressive space with your people and a sense of community, and then someone makes a comment that is derogatory or offensive or violent. So we'll have that. We have a session on feminist men and so how feminism has informed the worldview of men who have to reconcile their masculinity with feminism and what those tensions are and what the successes have been and the opportunities. That's going to be a really important session.
And then, you know, neoliberalism and queer theory and indigenous feminisms and masculinities and women in politics. Throughout all this, we're going to be learning how the speakers have learned to be assertive feminists themselves. We ask the speakers to share experiences of when their feminism has been challenged and when they face a difficult moment of having to really stand up for feminism as a movement. So throughout all these Monday nights, we'll be learning on multiple levels about what the speakers have been involved with and how they've come into their own feminist identities. There's a lot of opportunity to have group discussions. The session with the guest speaker runs from 6 o'clock until 8:30, and then between 8:30 and 9, the participants have an opportunity to speak amongst themselves. The speaker leaves, and for half an hour, we talk about anything that's come up, so we do group reflections and we share. That's the time when that trust is built and the sense of community is built and the participants really get to know each other and get to know their lived experiences and other people's experiences with gender discrimination and gender empowerment as well. We have 20 participants, which is the max that the room can hold. So there were physical limitations on how many people could participate, and there were more applicants than there was room for, which was very exciting for me and spoke to the fact that there is an interest in the community. So of the 20 people who are participating, there are cis women and cis men. There are trans people involved, and there are people who identify as queer. There is an immigrant participant from Bangladesh, and Indigenous women are participating. So there's quite a lot of diversity in that sense. Mostly women are in it, mostly cis women, and mostly young women, although there wasn't a cap on the age. So it is meant for adults, like, you know, age 20 and up. And so the majority of the people participating are between 23 and 30, but there are older women participating as well, and older men as well.
What is it that you hope results from this? Obviously, one thing is you hope that the people who are attending will learn things and have an opportunity to have interesting conversations and that kind of thing. But beyond those kind of individual gains for the participants, do you want action to come out of this? Are you hoping that some sort of group or collective will come out of it?
Yeah, the potential for networking in this group is incredible. Already I see that the participants support one another in a very profound way, and they want to be there for each other. So what I see coming out of this is that people will come away wanting to get more involved. And so whether that's volunteering with existing organizations that support women, I think there will be people who come away wanting to do more on that front. And I think there could be some people involved in forming something like a collective outside of this and taking this in their own direction. I certainly did that with Next Up. That's what I took out of Next Up, and I started this. And so I'm hoping that someone from this project can start something else as well. So the networking is a big part of it. The resource sharing is another major part of this. We have a page on the website where we post articles and videos and podcasts and movies and anything at all that's online that can be posted. We post on this resource page, and that's a really important part of bringing the discussions that we have into the community. The hope is that the participants take these articles and, you know, podcasts and videos and everything else and share those with their networks and their communities and their families and any spaces that they occupy, that if conversations come up that link back to something that we've been talking about, that there's an opportunity to share these articles and these resources with people who aren't in the camp but could also benefit from the discussions that we're having. So that's one big thing. And the other big takeaway is the skills that we're going to be building, the skills around the counter-narrative and constructing narratives that affirm feminist values. We're going to have an intensive session towards the end where we learn how to speak assertively, especially when our values are challenged, which can be a very emotional moment. When our own values around equality and respect for gender and diversity are challenged by people who benefit from the status quo and benefit from their privilege, we're going to be learning from somebody who is an expert in media messaging and therefore like tight messaging and someone else who is a public speaking expert. So they're going to put together their skills to teach us how to respond when someone says, you know, oh, women have it pretty good and you're just angry and you just need some action or whatever it is that really distracts from the issue at heart. And we're surrounded by this in our culture, in our society, with people who stand to lose when their own privilege is challenged. And when that happens, there's a lot that people who stand to lose can pull from in terms of the narratives that they use, because that is the society that we live in. Despite all the progressive social work that's happening, I would argue that we're still in a patriarchal society where there is oppression and there is discrimination. And so how do we, as feminists in this camp, build those counter-narratives so that we know what to anticipate and we know how to respond when someone says, you're making this up, there's no such thing as patriarchy because women can do anything they want. What are you complaining about? You have it good. And when someone says that, what do we say in response? Because sometimes what happens is we don't even know where to start with that because there's so much to say that we just sometimes can shut down or walk away or just make it personal and say, you know, you're an idiot for saying that. And the conversation doesn't go anywhere. So how do we capitalize on those moments and turn them into moments when we can really assert ourselves and say, these are all the reasons that I'm doing what I'm doing and that maybe you should rethink that rape joke or maybe you should, you know, really reevaluate your privilege and the benefits that you get in your position in society. But often we don't do that and we don't know how to respond because it can be so overwhelming because it's a threat to our own experiences and because someone questions our experiences and does it in a very threatening way often. So that's going to be, I think, one of the bigger takeaways, how we personally can feel empowered to speak to those situations and to speak truth to those situations and really call on our own collective knowledge of feminist issues to respond.
Connected to the idea of speaking and acting from your own experience, the ways in which speaking from our experiences of oppression or exploitation or marginalization is often very different than speaking from and to our experiences of privilege, and that the latter is also important, that sometimes, for example, recognizing whiteness and stepping back and not speaking can be very important, but there are other moments where it is very important to speak, but to do it in a way that is specific to our experience of, say, white privilege or of other kinds of privilege. So tell me a little bit about how you've integrated that very different kind of speaking from experience, both in your own journey, but also in the ways that the camp is operating.
It's such an important part of what we do because we've learned as feminists and as people who identify with the progressive movement that there's so much diversity of experience within that and that we can be agents of oppression despite the fact that in other zones we can be working towards positive change. So the camp is mostly made up of white people and they have different identities within that, and this is not to erase any of those other identities. The race part of the issue is certainly present. And I think that that's such an important part of the discussion, to talk about how we acknowledge that and how we call our communities to account for that. The session that we have on other progressive spaces where we encounter gender blindness and or gender discrimination, I think that's going to be a really important foundation to the rest of the camp to raise awareness and consciousness around the fact that just because we identify as feminists doesn't mean that we have it all figured out. And certainly as feminists, we can be transphobic, we can be homophobic, we can be racist. The way that I tried to structure the sessions of the camp have both spoken to that need to bring in the diversity. So for instance, we have a session on Indigenous feminisms and masculinities to challenge our colonial place as feminists, because feminism has a history of excluding women of color. There's also another opportunity towards the end of the camp to do, the last session is left open for people to suggest their own issues and topics that they're interested in. So we're going to be selecting that last topic based on participant interest as well. The other topics have been chosen by me ahead of the start of the program. So there is room there to talk about privilege. I think that will be a thread that runs throughout it, that we will be consistently challenged on our own assumptions and whatever biases that we have as a result of our privilege, that'll come out very strongly, I think, in the discussions around these intersections when speakers come in and pull out themes that, you know, this isn't just feminism that's blind to race and ability and body type and age, that people experience these issues at various intersections. So I think that the privilege part of the puzzle is going to be a really important part of it because it'll come out in every single session.
Thank you for tuning into Women on Air today. If you were interested in the two interviews that aired, they were from Talking Radical Radio, so I encourage you to check them out. They have a podcast on Rabble and a website that you can take a look at. We have one song by Kitami, and it's the song called Safehouse Anthem. So enjoy, stay tuned for an amazing show coming up next, and I will talk to you next week.